Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's Pizza in lovely Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. And today we are on the line with Bill Savage of Pungo Creek Mills. Bill, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
So I am really excited to chat with you today. I don't even know where I came across the bag of your amazing cornmeal that was in my freezer. I've made a couple batches of some of the most delicious cornbread in the history of my life, and prompted me to kind of reach out today and hear a little bit more about the story behind this great product. So I wanted to start by getting a sense of how you became an Indian corn grower.
Well, it was sort of by accident, I guess you would say. I just stumbled into it. In October of 2006, I found a local farmer who was still producing this heirloom Indian corn, and he had gotten down to where he was just producing a small garden, maybe a quarter of an acre or something like that. And I got talking with him, and he said his grandfather had been growing it since the 1870s, something like that. And so I said, well, you know, I got talking about it before. I said, well, I'd like to purchase a bushel of it from you. So we worked out a deal, and I purchased a bushel of the corn. And in April of 2007, I took the seed from that bushel of corn, and I planted the first crop, which turned out to be about 50 rows or about a half acre of corn. That September, I harvested it, and we were trying to make some wreaths. We were going to sell some Indian corn wreaths like you'd see for decorations. That's what we figured everybody used to use this stuff for. So made those up and couldn't give them away. We couldn't compete with some of the foreign markets. A lot of the wreaths and things are coming in from Mexico and all, and it just didn't work out on that. So in November of the same year, 2007, we shelled the corn from the remaining wreaths, and we ground it into chicken feed. I had an old 1930s John Deere Letts feed mill. And the corn, it smelled so good and had a unique texture, and it said, you know, this would be something neat to try to grind and make some bread just for fun, you know. So we ground it up, and my uncle and my father were helping me. So I gave them a little bit, and I took a little bit, and we all tried making some cornbread, and it was some of the best we had ever had. Just it has a flavor, you know, all to its own. So I decided at that point, I said, what would it take, you know, to start a small grist mill again. There were none existing on the shore since about the 1940s. So I went through and started doing a little bit of research on it. In the meantime, we planted our next crop by April 2008, and this crop was roughly 2 acres. We got that harvested out in September, and in December, we went ahead and completed all the necessary red tape that it would take to start the mill up. And also in December 2008, I purchased a small, it was an 8-inch Meadows tabletop little electric grist mill. And in January of 2009, Pungo Creek Mills began production of our heirloom Indian corn meal. That was our first year of actual production. During that year in June, we had some culinary students visit us from the University of Delaware toward the mill as we headed at that point, which was more or less our enclosed trailer that we had our tabletop mill set up in, and a little hand sifting rig that we had made to sift all the cornmeal out. So we decided after that first season that in December 2009, I said, we've got to try to upgrade the mill a little bit. I was getting away from hand sifting, and the orders were a little more than the little 8-inch mill would keep up with. So at that point, we purchased a 12-by-28 Dutch barn that we refitted as the mill house, and we purchased a locally restored, it was a 1935 Meadows 20-inch vertical stone mill, and a 1969 Metta's cornmeal bolter to sift the cornmeal with. And we started powering that with a Farmall Cub tractor, and then later on with a 1947 Farmall H tractor that we ran a belt right through the wall of the mill to power it with. So in March of 2010, we took the product to the Richmond, to the Food and Beverage Expo they had there every other year, and we won the Best New Food Product Award at that time. So that gave us a good opportunity to promote the product through numerous newspaper articles, and people would stop by and give us a little bit more publicity than we had had before. So that was a good thing for us. And then in June of 2010, we had several of the national food writers toward the Eastern Shore food producers, and they included our mill in the tour, so they came by, and that was a nice time, too, to get to share that with the food writers. In September of 2010, my brother and I attended the Virginia Folklife Apprenticeship Program in Charlottesville, Virginia, to showcase the product. And also, my brother began an apprenticeship program for a period of 1 year so that he could learn the art of grist milling, and he could take over the mill in my absence. That way, if I had to step away from it or if I was sick for a time, he would be able to keep it running. So that was in September. And in October 2010, we had the worst drought we've seen in probably a century, and we lost the entire crop that year.
Wow.
That was one of the toughest years we've had to date, but we were able to save a little bit of seed for the next year's planting, and at that time we introduced a second line of product, which was Amish-grown yellow flint cornmeal, and that was, we were going to use that to keep the mill going and introduce it as a second line until the 2011 crop was harvested. But that flint, it worked fairly well, but the sales just were not, they weren't as good as what our heirloom Indian corn was, and everybody wanted the heirloom Indian corn, and so we ended up dropping that line in 2012. So we kept on, we had in, let's see here, in December of 2010, we were interviewed for a TV program called Down Home Virginia. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
No, I'll have to check it out.
Well, you look it up online if you have that on there, I believe. But in January of 2011, we were invited to attend Governor McDonald's USDA reception in Richmond, and we served samples of the product and showcased the product. So I thought that was a pretty good honor, too, to be able to serve product at the governor's behalf. In August of 2011, we were invited to showcase the product and our milling process for Virginia State University's Agricultural Field Day. And that we had a fun time there. In September 2011, we harvested our new crop and replaced the 2010 harvest that was destroyed, and we were able to resupply all of our distributors. In December of 2012, we were interviewed for a second television program. It was Travels with Charlie, and that aired on Channel 16 out of Salisbury, Maryland. And September 2013, I was interviewed for a newspaper article by the Delmarva Media Group based in Salisbury, Maryland. This article, I expect it to be printed in the near future, probably next month, but I have to keep posted on that one.
Nice.
And then the last thing I have here, next month, which will be November, which actually will be tomorrow, I guess, in 2013 here, my brother and myself are establishing a sister company, which is Old Dominion Pipe Company, to produce handcrafted traditional Indian corn cob pipes, and they'll be made from the surplus Pung Creek Mill's Indian corn cobs. And that facility is currently under construction, and I hope it'll be in operation around Thanksgiving. So we're trying to make use of all of our byproducts as well, and not have so much waste as some production facilities would have. But that's basically our story in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's a very comprehensive nutshell. Thank you. Well, I wanna go back in and chat a little bit more about some different points along the way. But before we go any further, I guess we should let folks know, you know, I can tell from your accent, and I'm sure our listeners have picked up that you are, you know, not a New York State farmer. You guys are located, just outside of Paynter, Virginia?
We're Paynter, Virginia. It's on Virginia's eastern shore. We're across the Chesapeake Bay. Everybody thinks about Virginia as the mainland on the other side, and we have the Chesapeake Bay between us and the main part of the state. We're actually attached physically to Maryland. It's a little, just a little small peninsula, but we're located down in the lower portion of Accomack County, and it's isolated and rural here, but we like it. It's very quiet and peaceful most of the time.
Lovely. So the seed, now, so corn is one of those agricultural products that you can save. Actually, the kernel of corn that you eat is the same as a kernel of corn that you would plant for a crop. That's right?
That's right.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry. What we do when we harvest the corn every year, we air cure it. That way we can get the moisture out of it, both for grinding in the mill, but also you have to get the moisture level out to store it in order to be able to replant it for the following year. And what we do, we converted some what used to be peanut curing trailers, and we have air fans that blow through the trailers. They have little ductwork underneath of them, and we tarp them, and we blow a high volume velocity of air through that ductwork, and then the floor is perforated, so all that air is forced up through the floor and through the load of corn that's sitting in the trailer, and over a period of a couple months, it will cure the moisture out and get the corn ready for the shelling process.
Now, that's like the thing you call the corn crib. Like, if you're driving around in rural parts of the state, you'll see kind of the old buildings with, like, the slat-like air holes in them. Is that right?
Essentially, that's what it does. I do have a circa 1918 corn crib that I moved and brought it to the mill, and I've used it for basic storage, but I haven't cured a lot of corn in there. But the peanut trailers, the idea behind it is essentially the same thing as your old corn cribs. It's just that I like the airflow process a little bit better. If you let it sit stagnant, and if your airflow is not correct or you don't have enough airflow through it, then the corn can potentially go through a heat and go bad, you know, ruin on you. So you've kind of, through trial and error, we've learned and made mistakes. We had a crib go bad one year and lost, probably 5 or 6 good pickup loads of the Indian corn that we had to throw away because we didn't have enough airflow through it, and the corn went bad and had to be destroyed. So when you learn from mistakes like that, you learn not to make them again.
Yeah, you learn real quick, I'm sure. So
that's it.
At the time, I mean, farming wasn't your, and still isn't your primary profession. Is that right?
That's right. I've always had a hand in farming to an extent since I was a boy. As soon as I could reach the pedals on the tractor, I've helped out on the family farm. But like my father, he made his living off of the farm and farmed evenings and weekends, that type of thing. He used to work for the Agricultural Research Station in Painter, and I've worked at various jobs besides, you know, the farm work. My current job right now, I'm working with Virginia's Department of Transportation, but I've always had an interest in the agricultural side and farming, and we live on a small farm anyway, so it's nice to be able to keep that small farm dream alive. And sometimes, you know, if you take your time and put your heart into it, you know, you can come up with a product that maybe is a little bit more superior to all the modern mechanization they have out there. You know, we still use old-fashioned methods and antique equipment to do most of our processing, and I believe that through, you know, hand selection and some of the older, more laid-back techniques, I believe you can come up with a more superior finished product. So that's more of what I've strived. It's more been quality to me than quantity.
Yeah, and I would definitely, I mean, I would 100% agree, having tasted the product, that it was, I have to say, you know, when I was eating, I'm like, man, if this is cornmeal, what's that other stuff I've been eating? Because that's such a unique, you know, texture, and this real, almost like a real kind of almost umami flavor to it, and the recipe that you guys have printed on the back is, you know, much wetter than other cornbread recipes that I've used, and I've cooked it, you know, 3 times for 3 different dinner parties, and I have to say it's the thing that people keep asking me about. So I think you guys, I mean, you're really hitting the mark, and it's really delicious. I'm really excited to kind of share your story and learn a little bit more with the listeners. We are we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about the corn, so hang tight.
You are listening to Written from the Pantheon by Iggy Dean on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
All right, we are back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. This is the Farm Report. And we're on the line today with Bill Savage of Pungo Creek Mills down in just outside of Paynter, Virginia. Now, Bill, the corn that you're growing, you know, I know heirloom varieties often have a slightly different requirements. You know, they take a little bit longer to grow or they look a little different. Can you tell us, you know, if we were to walk into a field of your corn, how it would stand up in kind of size and color to the, you know, more conventional varieties that we're used to seeing?
Well, for one thing, this corn, for the most part, if it gets the proper fertilizer, it can grow 10 to 12 feet high stalks. And that generally will stand above most of your modern hybrid corn. That's one obvious sign that you can look if you walked in a field of mine versus a modern field of, say, yellow dent corn. And most of my ears on that corn will grow approximately a foot long. We also have, there's different colorations in the stalks of the corn. And when you go out there and look, you'll see sometimes a purple stalk, which generally will show a red, like a bloody butcher ear will be on that one. That's where the corn comes from. They call it the old bloody butcher ear, which was a bright red corn. I mean, it's you can tell that corn from any other just, you know, in a quick glance. But the different colorations in the stalks, and I'd say the toughness. Those stalks are seem to be a lot thicker and tougher when you go to harvest it. When you put it through the picker, it seems like it's a lot more difficult for the picker to digest it than it would some of the more modern corn. So that's a few of the obvious things that you can tell about it.
And now this corn, you know, when you harvest in the fall, is it something that you could eat fresh?
You could eat, are you speaking maybe like sweet corn type?
Yeah.
Or you could actually try an ear or two with it, but believe it or not, it doesn't have the flavor until you get it cured.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pull it right out of the field, you know, in early summer, midsummer like that, it has the look and texture of sweet corn. And actually, until late in the summer, most of it still looks sort of yellow and white. It doesn't get its color till later on. But if you pull it in the fall when it's about ready to harvest, then, of course, it firms up. The kernels get hard, and then you break your teeth trying to chew on those. I mean, until you grind them up. So it's more in that respect like your old traditional, you know, what they call the horse corn around here, or the dent corn. Same idea there. But I think this corn, it has something different in it. It's more like I guess more natural sugars or something. There's a flavor difference that I can't duplicate, and I've tried other corn with my recipes and all. I can't duplicate the exact flavor with it, and I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm not an expert in analysis and all that type of thing, so I don't know what causes it. But we have a lot of customers that have that celiac type problem that can't eat wheat, and they can eat our corn, of course. We also have some of the customers we've had that can't eat regular corn that can eat our corn.
Huh.
And I don't know why that is, but, you know, other than the fact that it's heirloom and, it, you know, it's not a hybrid variety, and maybe there's something different. Maybe if, you know, corn's genetically modified, maybe it does something and triggers an allergy, but I don't know that. You know, I'm just guessing. Sometimes you try to figure out why something happens, and, you know, maybe that's a reason behind it.
Well, I think you definitely, like, lead with the flavor anyway. I'm like, it tastes good. It makes me feel good when I eat it. Now, you guys use a vintage corn picker. And can you talk to me a little bit? Well, you know, you mentioned a couple of times in the intro section that you use a lot of older equipment, antique equipment. I'm curious about a couple of things with regards to that. Is the choice for those tools because of the corn, that the size or the lack of more modern mechanization just fits the system better? And also, you know, where are you getting all this stuff from? Is there's like some kind of vintage farming equipment depot that folks can head down to, or how does that work?
Well, I'm trying to answer them one at a time here. The reason that we use the vintage equipment, the fact is, our corn, in order to properly shell it, we need to get our moisture levels well below 17%. I try to get it at least 14% before I shell. Most combines will pick it in the 20% range, something like that, maybe 20 to 24, something in that order. But when they pick it, they're taking it right to a granary, and the granaries have propane drying rigs, and they're huge volume rigs, and they're trying to do tons at a time. And so I don't have that, you know, that facility, so I don't want to shell it when the moisture level is too high. I want my corn to be at the proper level, and if I try to shell the Indian corn with a high moisture content, it tends to scalp it. In other words, it'll cut the tops off the kernels, and if it does that, then it ruins them. So that's one reason that I've shied away from the combines, and the other reason behind it is I can do more hand selection. I can actually run my corn across a belt and check to make sure if I have a bad ear or ear that doesn't match or meet my criteria or my standards, I can pull that ear off the line before it ever goes to the shelling mechanism. And a combine can't do that.
Right.
So I can therefore produce a superior product, although it's more time-consuming and more labor-intensive. But that was a lot of the reason that I stuck with the older equipment. Another reason is the older equipment is cheaper than mm-hmm. when I purchased in a more modern combine. And the equipment that I have found it in various locations. I purchased some of it fairly local. A lot of it came out of Maryland. Some of it came out of Pennsylvania. And I've looked around at farm sales. I've gone to auctions, some of the antique tractor and machinery type shows. I've picked up some of it there and just acquired a little bit along. It started out, you know, more as the hobby when we were looking at the reef part of it, and I was just picking up a piece or two just for fun. And then the stuff I started picking up for fun, when I got to the point of starting the mill, I needed the stuff. So that's when I put the old-time equipment back in service. And, I mean, we've got equipment. The oldest corn sheller I have, I think, is 1886. It's a AH Patch Blackhawk, little box-type sheller. You shell it, drop it into a barrel, is what it was designed for. But the largest sheller I have, let's see, that's a 1940s era Minneapolis Moline stationary cylinder sheller. That one you have to hook up to a tractor, and it'll do, I think it's rated at 175 bushels an hour. I've never put that kind of volume through it, but that you drop all the corn on it, and it has a conveyor mechanism that runs it all through there and runs it through a cylinder and drops the cobs on one side into a trailer, and then it puts the shelled corn into a funnel body on the other side. So it does all the work without having to sit there and drop individual cobs into a small sheller. We started out doing that, and by the end of the day, your back knows it if you've been dropping, you know, several hundred to a few thousand corn cobs through an old-fashioned sheller. I think that's why they did away with them after a while.
Right. You can feel the difference. Now,
it definitely.
So the corn, the corn stays on the stalks till, you know, mid-fall, and it's, you know, while it's on the stalks, it's drying out, and then you harvest it, and you shell it right after harvest, and then it's dried, then it's air dried to cure it to
well,
the point before you, okay, is it, go ahead.
I'll say what we do normally, I'll run you real briefly through the process. We will plant it toward the end of April, early May, somewhere in there. We harvest generally mid-September to early October, depending on when the moisture's right. And we put it, when we harvest it with an old, it's a Ford one row, I think it's a 601 corn picker. It mounts on the tractor and you drive it through the field and it pulls the corn off the stalk, leaves it on the cob. It has a husking bed. It pulls some of the husk off. It puts the corn in a funnel body behind the tractor that's attached to it. Then we pull that to the house, and then we have an elevator that we drop the corn out of the funnel body onto the elevator, and that puts it into the converted peanut curing trailers. Then we blow the air through it for a couple months.
Okay.
When it comes out of the peanut trailers, then it's ready to go through the corn sheller and
be
stored to go to the mill.
Okay. And I hear it said that the corn sheller is powered by a hit-and-miss engine. What is that?
Well, we have a hit-and-miss. It's a 1947 International Harvester. That engine is what we call throttle-governed. This one fires roughly every other revolution. And it's a water-cooled engine. It holds about a gallon and a half to 2 gallons of water, and the water just sits in a big hopper. And as she fires and runs, it actually steams the water out of it. That's what causes it to cool. It just distributes that heat through the water, and you'll see the steam rising off the thing. And it's makes a unique sound when she's firing. What I used that for, I had a 1909 A. Butch & Son two-hole corn sheller. And prior to the use of our 1940s Minneapolis, that sheller was all I had for the first year and a half to 2 years of shelling the corn. So I belted that engine up there, and I used it to shell all the corn. You know, with that method, the engine would turn the belt pulley on the corn sheller. And I still use it today because what I do a lot of times is I'll pour my shelled corn through that same unit with that engine belted up to it in order to go through another cleaning process. I like to go through two or three stages of cleaning process before it actually goes through the mill. So I still use it in more or less as a cleaning type operation now. But it's very efficient. That machine, that little engine, probably will run all day on a gallon and a half of fuel.
Wow.
It's better than most automobiles now.
Once it has gone through the corn sheller, is there another aging process before it gets milled, or?
Well, what we do, we purchase brand new sandbags, is the way I store it, because they're polypropylene and they're woven, and it allows the corn to breathe. And I put it in my grain house, which is a temperature-controlled building as well, and let it sit in there, and that further dries it out. I mean, you'll slowly drop a percent along. And what I try to do there is just keep my crop safe and stored and just keep it on more or less slow drying. I have an AC unit that I run in there, and it helps pull any moisture out of the building. And I keep a fan running on it 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, that keeps air circulating through that building. And I believe that it helps to keep that stable. If you put that in a hot building, then you would have problems because there's no preservatives on it. So temperature control for me is key to try to keep it as high quality as possible. I want to keep a good crop, and you don't want weevils and that type of thing to develop. So
sure. So now the next step in the process is the milling. So can you talk a little bit? I know you mentioned it in the beginning, but what is the mill that you're using now? And can you just walk us through the milling aspect of things?
Okay. Well, the mill I use now, I say it's a 1935. It's a Meadows 20-inch vertical stone mill. In other words, the stones, instead of being horizontal, they're set vertically in that particular mill, and they face each other. You have a standing stone that sits still, and you have a running stone that's turned by the tractor. The tractor turns a pulley on one end of the mill, and that's what does the revolutions of it. It turns up about at 700 RPM, and when you pour the corn in the top, it has a hopper that holds about 150 pounds. Well, that will go through that about every half hour, 45 minutes. She'll go through that 150 pounds of corn. It grinds it, and you have a little wheel on the side that you adjust for how fine you want that corn to be, how fine you want the meal to be on it, and that just, it's more rack of the eye than anything. There's no gauges to set that. You just have to learn that from time. And when it comes out of the mill, it drops into a bucket. Well, I take that bucket, and then I pour that into the bolter machine, and the bolter, essentially, it looks like a combine reel that's wrapped in a specific mesh stainless steel screen. And what happens is when you dump the cornmeal into that you flip a switch and a motor starts rotating that reel. And when it rotates, the cornmeal falls through into one hopper section of it down into a tray, and then the rest of the what we call the bran or larger portions that are too big to consume, they walk all off the end of that reel and drop into another bucket, and I recycle those as chicken feed. So I'm able to get the specific size that I'm looking for with that cornmeal. From there, the cornmeal is put into a bulk hopper, and then we have a hand crank that we crank out a certain amount of turns per bag, and that'll give us a rough estimate of what is supposed to be in that bag. Then we put it on scale, and we finish putting the correct amount of cornmeal in there until we get it full. And from there, we go ahead and we'll label the bag and put the batch and date of what we're processing there that particular day. And then it goes back. We store that in the greenhouse as well because, again, it's temperature controlled, and that's a good place to keep it until it goes to market. We generally do 300-pound batches, something like that. I'd rather do a lot of small batches than a few big ones, because that way I keep a better handle on the market and try to keep the dates in a less of time between the grind dates. Is what you're trying to do. You want to get it to market as quick as possible. So that's the basic process behind that. And one other thing about that mill, it is a local mill. That mill came out of Machapunga. A friend of mine, Bill Jardine, has Quail Cove Company down there. I purchased that mill from him, and he had bought it from a local farmer, and apparently it was in a mill on site there to Machapunga. Well, Bill sent it over to Meadows Mills, which is still in business in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, and they factory rebuilt it. So when I purchased it from him and put it back in service, it's the first time that mill had been in operation probably since the 1960s. It had been a long time, but it felt good to get an old Eastern Shore mill up and running again.
Yeah, I'll bet. Now, the storage for, so once the grain has been ground, then you're kind of working against the clock, as you mentioned. There is a freshness factor there. So once folks get a bag of freshly ground cornmeal, I mean, if they can help themselves to not eat it immediately, which is what I'll be doing when I get my next order, what is the best way for them to store it to make sure that it's fresh when they're ready to use it?
Generally, the worst enemy of this type of cornmeal, because, again, there's no preservatives in it, you don't want to leave it in a hot, high humidity environment. Most people I recommend, if it's going to be a week or two, generally it's not a big issue. If you're in most people in air-conditioned homes this day and time anyway, even in the warmer weather. But if you're worried about it for just a few weeks to a month or so, put it in the refrigerator. And if you'd like to store it for months at a time, we have actually done a test, and we have stored some for up to a year in a freezer. We put it in a plastic bag, seal it up, and put it into a chest freezer, and brought it out a year later, it was still fine. So you can extend the date, pretty far in the future if you'd like to. It's bad for me because I can't sell you cornmeal if you're storing it in there. But then again, that's the way to do it if you're gonna store that for months at a time. But most people can't let it last that long. They tend to eat it up a little sooner than that.
So now if folks want to purchase a corn, they can definitely visit the website, www.pungocreekmills.net. And then I know you're available in a number of locations around the Virginia area, which are listed on your website. Is there any other way that would be good for folks who are kind of looking to taste your cornmeal, or is visiting the website probably the best?
Well, the website's one way, and we're working on our PayPal account currently. We had a couple issues in trying to get that running a little bit more efficiently. We accept personal check if people would like to mail us a check for the corn they'd like to purchase. They can contact me directly. I can give you a email address. It might be the easiest way.
Sure.
Or a telephone number. Email address, okay, it's Pungo, P-U-N-G-O, Creek Mills, with the at symbol, Verizon.net is my email address. And if you don't have email, I have a phone number of 757-442-6327. And I'd be glad to talk with them as far as prices and shipping boxes for his retail. We do, again, we have some wholesale locations. They're primarily in Virginia. We sell a lot to Whole Foods in Charlottesville, Richmond, Virginia Beach. We sell some to historical locations such as Monticello. And I sell some locally on the shore. I don't know if you've heard of the Blue Crab Bay Company. Okay, we sell to them, and they actually ship it sometimes for us internationally. I don't get into shipping it overseas a whole lot because it's so much
more. It's a real headache.
It's with the customs and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And if you're shipping powder and that type of stuff back and forth, I'd rather let somebody else deal with that headache. But they do ship some. I've had emails from all over the world, you know, people that would like to purchase a little bit of it, and I generally refer them to them in that case. We have, like I said, we have several small locations here in Virginia, and I know it doesn't help people in New York on that, but I'll work with you. If anybody wants it, if I have to sell it myself directly from the mill, I'll do that, because we do have an online price for people that just don't have access any other way to get a hold of it.
So. Excellent.
We'll definitely work with you on that.
Well, Bill, we are unfortunately out of time, but thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to tell us a little bit more about the corn. And folks, definitely do yourself a favor, buy a couple bags of the cornmeal, and enjoy some great cornbread. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Well, I appreciate it, and thank you for having me on the program.
Again, that's Pungo Creek Mills. Learn more about them by visiting www.pungocreekmills.net. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been another episode of The Farm Report. This, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, are available for free. Check out our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you like what you hear, please consider clicking that Donate tab and becoming a member today. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.